So we're rolling straight into our bloggers roundtable with more analysis of the race and tech blogging controversy. Plus, we'll look at the case of a high school yearbook that gave black students phony ghetto names. And two companies pull their ads from popular BET programs. With us, media consultant Carmen Dixon. She writes the blog All About Race and also blogs for AOL Black Voices. Brandon Whitney runs the blog Homeland Colors. He also writes about politics for the websites Black Men in America and My Voice DC. And Mark Lamont Hill, professor of American Studies at Temple University. He blogs at marklamonthill.com and The Root. Hi, folks.
How you doing?
Good morning.
Hey, good to be here.
Well, we just heard about the fallout from Lauren Feldman's video post. A lot of people think they were offensive. Verizon came under fire for partnering with him. There were actually protests here in Los Angeles, and recently dropped him and his distribution deal like a hot potato. So, Carmen, when you're a white guy and you do a video blog called the Tech N-Word, and I'm using the kind of polite phrase, are you just begging for attention? Was this just a publicity stunt?
I think it was a poorly executed publicity stunt. If you watch the video, it's clumsy, it's hackneyed, and it wasn't even funny. And I think the thing about it is, for him to pretend that he didn't know that there were African-American tech bloggers out there, either he was woefully simply ignorant or he doesn't get out enough. And I think that the important point of this is we can't police everything that people say in real life or on the web, but we can certainly choose not to patronize companies who sponsor distributing this kind of content.
So, Mark, is that really the issue, whether or not he gets, you know, because Huffington Post dropped him, Verizon, you know, his issues had been out there for a while, but once they became a protestable issue, I guess, Verizon backed away. I mean, is the issue commerce as much as anything else?
Oh, it's absolutely the case. As we know, corporations don't have feelings, they have interests. And it's only at the moment where a consumer base threatens to withdraw their financial investments in these companies where they actually get a social conscience. And so I don't think that it was this grand social benevolence by these corporations, but a sense that people are going to pull back. And I think it's a wise thing. I think in the wake of in the aftermath of Don Imus, it's absolutely critical that we act swiftly and consistently whenever we see these representations, these insulting representations of black and brown people.
Brandon, when you take a look at this, what does it say to you about the tech community? I mean, you know, bloggers come in many stripes, and some of them are more techie, some are more cultural. But do you think the tech community has some racial baggage it needs to unload?
I don't think they have any more than anybody else. And I don't even look at what he did as something that was really based in tech. He was trying to be funny, and it was offensive. And the thing about offensive humor is you have to make sure it's at least funny. His execution, everything, it just wasn't funny. There was no moment where you listened to him and you even cracked a smirk. But as far as the tech community specifically, I mean, it's the same everywhere. There's an underlying racism culturally that we all have, whether you're black, white, or whatever creed or race, that we all have subconsciously at least. And I think he was just tone deaf. Well, except for the fact that he got very angry about an anti-Semitic comment somebody made. So it's kind of weird to call it. I can't tell if he knew he was being offensive or not. He just seemed extremely tone deaf and not funny.
All right. Well, Brandon, I want you to comment on another story that we've got on the table. It's a California story that's making national headlines. There's a high school in Covina called Charter Oak, and they're investigating how a student on the yearbook staff was able to get fake names like Tay-Tay Shaniqua and Laquan White printed for photos of the members of the Black Student Union. Some of the students' real first names are Jordan, Sierra, and Paisley. You know, that's a little preppy. So the student body, or maybe it's a Prince thing, the student body of the high school is about 4.5% black, 45% Hispanic, 30% white. I know Covina because there's a good mall there. But, you know, Brandon, do you think that this is something where, you know, school officials should have cracked down? Because they really just were sort of like, you know, it's a shame, but they didn't really crack down.
I think most likely the school officials can't tell real African-American names from fake ones. And it comes from a lot of different things. I think part of it is that African-American culture, and I don't mean black people, I don't mean the black race, but the culture that evolved here in the United States is not recognized and it's not respected. I've been searching up and down for linguists who will actually track the evolution of African-American names in the United States. Nobody's done it. Nobody's actually looked at the fact that in the 60s and 70s, people wanted to reconnect with Africa, and they gave themselves African names, and eventually it evolved to the point where we actually have our own naming system, where suffixes like la, or excuse me, prefixes like la or suffixes like quisha or keisha are actually create names that are unique to the African-American community. The culture, it's more about the culture. People don't respect African-Americans as a culture, not just people who happen to be of the race that's considered black. And I think that's really at the root of what's going on out there.
Carmen, this came from the blog Racialicious, and of course one of our contributors here, Carmen Van Kerkhove, another Carmen, is the one who runs Racialicious. And the point made in the article was also like, well, you know, people talk about Generation Next or whatever, but are they really any more informed culturally? I mean, do you think that people who are teens are more culturally sensitive or more multicultural, or does this show that people are still fighting in the sandbox?
Well, it's a tricky thing because this one example, I'm not sure what we can extrapolate that to, but I think in general, there was a lot, about a few months ago, there was a lot of writing about how this generation next is more color neutral or color blind, and I just don't see it. Out on the web, there are plenty of stories of either walking in with a Confederate flag into graduation ceremonies in a predominantly black audience, or just a number of incidences that would indicate, or in Kansas, where the young black man, the young eighth grader, was spray painted white, tied down and spray painted white by some graduating seniors. I think that we are all influenced by the cultures around us. And I don't think you can say that young people are immune to the racism and images that they see around them in America.
I think we also have to remember that things change, but they change slowly. I mean, things are better than it was for our parents. I think that America is less racist than it was in our parents' generation, but it's still there, and it's a slow, gradual process. We're all infected with the culture of racism here, and we have to all work on it. So I think the kids are a lot better than our parents were, and probably than I was coming up, so...
I think one of the challenges, though, is that there are certain aspects of racism and white supremacy that we confront head on, and as a result, we're able to sort of negotiate them better. You know, being a kid being painted, or we look at the blackface parties and the ghetto parties that we see in college campuses around the nation over the last few years. We deal with those things because we take them seriously to some extent. But when you talk about making fun of African-American names, it speaks to a broader trend of normalizing Eurocentric values, Eurocentric ideas, Eurocentric names, Eurocentric European culture. And that's not something that schools take seriously. I mean, we live in a world where schools still don't take seriously African-American culture, Latino culture, Asian cultures. None of these things are taken seriously. And so when people make fun of black names, it doesn't necessarily raise the same red flag because people just don't care about that. There's a sense that there's a Central American culture which marginalizes those who are considered other.
Mark, very quickly before we go to a break, you're at Temple, a predominantly black school. Is this something that students talk about?
Unfortunately, not enough. You know, we're not predominantly black, but we have a large student body, and so we have more black folk than most HBCUs do. But there's still a sense of marginality that the African-American students face. And as a consequence, the types of conversations that they have about being marginal, about being other, about their names and their culture, oftentimes doesn't happen in full public view. And that's something that we need to really think seriously about, not just at Temple, but in colleges around the nation.
All right, guys, I want you to stick with us. We're going to go to a break. We are talking with bloggers Carmen Dixon, Brandon Whitney, and Mark Lamont Hill. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. We are back with our Bloggers Roundtable. With us, media consultant Carmen Dixon. She writes the blog All About Race and also blogs for AOL Black Voices. Brandon Whitney runs the blog Homeland Colors. He also writes about politics for the websites Black Men in America and My Voice DC. And Mark Lamont Hill is a professor of American Studies at Temple University. He blogs at marklamonthill.com and The Root. So I'm going to jump right back into it, guys. Moving on to a topic of television. The Enough is Enough campaign is declaring a victory. Earlier in the show, we heard our web producer Jeff Bennett talk about General Motors and Procter & Gamble pulling their ads from Black Entertainment Television's Rap City and 106 and Park programs. Both shows feature music videos, artist interviews. They have a largely under 18 after school audience. And for the past year, the Enough is Enough campaign has targeted some of BET's programs because of its, quote, demeaning and offensive portrayals of African Americans and women. Here is Reverend Delman Coates of Enough is Enough.
I want to be clear, our campaign is not an anti-hip-hop campaign. I grew up on hip-hop. This campaign is about those elements of commercial rap, which I distinguish from hip-hop, that we deem as a community offensive. And what we know is that when there's content that offends other communities, it doesn't get promoted. But when it offends black women and black people, it's regarded as entertainment. And what we're fighting for is the fundamental equality of black people in the public square.
So, Mark, it isn't as if these companies have left BET, but they've shifted their ad buys away from these shows. Do you think that that really is a victory?
I think it's a small victory, but it's part of a more protracted and long war that we have to win here. If GM moves from Rap City but goes earlier in the day toward 106 and Park, I don't think we've made much progress. The key here is to keep pressure on these companies in such a way that they eventually either leave the network or force the network to offer programming that provides humane representations of black and brown people. I mean, that's the critical point here.
Brandon, do you even think, I don't want to editorialize and say, you know, it is a victory if enough is enough wins. I mean, a lot of people would say, look, it's a diverse world. You can find if you're an adult, you can go and find adult programming on cable. You can find this, that, and the other, Christian, whatever. I mean, is this really just a question of people learning to control their expectations about what other people are watching?
I think people watch too much TV anyway. I mean, I hate what are considered moral issues. And I really think the quality of BET programs are one of those issues. Because it doesn't affect anything. Honestly, if the Reverend, and I don't know exactly who he is, but if the Reverend is serious about improving the African-American community, he could focus on programs that improve African-American lives. I don't mean television programs. I mean actually going out in the street and doing work. And also, I don't really believe much in boycotts and things of that nature. I'd rather do a boycott. You know, instead of giving the cable company my $100, I can be investing, which I do, invest in an African-American investment firm. So as opposed to all of this this hoopla over BET, which is just a cable station that doesn't affect anything, kids watch a couple of videos for an hour and a half, they could be focusing on things that actually make a difference in the community. So I really think it's pointless victory.
I'm sure we're going to make the same point. I think we have to be active on all fronts. I think it's important to be on the street organizing and sponsoring and supporting programs that are effective on the ground. But we cannot underestimate the power of the image telegraphed back to young black children of what they are and who they should become and who we idolize. I think that that's essential to creating a strong black psyche to see positive images. So if changing the ad buy will help influence video directors to make more positive images, hallelujah, why not?
I want to know what they're for. I know what these folks are against when they go against BET. What are they for? What are they supporting in the African-American community? Are they putting money into African-American HBCUs? Are they? And it doesn't have to be a lot. There are things that are way more important. We have to use triage. We have to focus on things that affect lives immediately. And BET is not one of those things.
Mark, got to keep it real tight.
When we look at the extraordinary role that media, new media, like internet, as well as videos play in kids' lives, this is no small thing. Kids don't spend 1 or 2 hours a week watching videos. Many of our children spend 20 to 30 hours watching television programs, particularly BET. And it does affect their sense of who they are, what they can be, who they look like. It controls what they buy, what they want to buy, what their aspirations are. It doesn't completely control it, but it has an overwhelming impact.
Huge.
And every major study shows this.
All right, guys. Great. And wrap it up. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
We've been talking with Brandon Whitney of the blog Homeland Colors. He was at our headquarters in Washington, D.C. Mark Lamont Hill teaches American Studies at Temple University. He blogs at marklamonthill.com and The Root. He was at Audio Post Studios in Philadelphia. And media consultant Carmen Dixon. She writes the blog All About Race, also blogs at AOL Black Voices, and she was with me at our NPR West studios. You can find links to their blogs and ours at nprnewsandnotes.org. And the conversation doesn't stop here. Our online series Speak Your Mind gives you a chance to sound off on the issues you care about. To find out how, go to our blog, nprnewsandviews.org, and click on Speak Your Mind.